Hey man, how's it going, y'all? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network, like usual, right around this time. Man, is it already almost the weekend again? It is. That's what the thing says. Cool. Today on the show, Gareth Porter's going to debunk some lies about Iran's nuclear program. No, this isn't a rerun. It's live here. The 31st of July, 2015. But, you know, they don't ever stop lying about Iran's nuclear program. And in this case, they're lying about the deal. And in this case, it's the evil Ali Heinonen telling ridiculous lies. And so Gareth Porter just, you know, examined the lies and then wrote down explanations of how come they weren't so. I like it when Gareth writes things. He says things like, this is not correct, and stuff like that. Ex-IAEA official uses misleading claims to attack Iran deal. Who among you thinks Gareth had a hard time tearing this idiot's lies apart? I know, right? None of us. And that's because Gareth is good at his job, and also because Ali Heinonen is completely full of it. Give me a break. Except for the few times where he admitted that he is completely full of it. In those cases, he was telling the truth. Yeah, no, we went out to Parchin, and it turns out I was completely full of it. There's nothing there. Okay, yeah, that's true. I think there could still be something there. No, shut up. You're a liar. Anyway, Ali Heinonen, he says things that aren't correct. Gareth Porter writes things that are correct. So, we'll let you guys decide on, you know, how it all balances out at the end. Yeah. And then that's it. Man, I invited so many goddamn people on my show today, and it just didn't work, man. I invited, I'm not going to sit here and tell you all about all the different people who aren't going to be on the show today, but it's a lot. Today on the show, lots of people will not be interviewed. But that's all right, because I already know everything anyway. Mostly. So, you know, I just fill in the gap myself. There's plenty to talk about. See, I better jot this down. We got to talk about Yemen. Oh, we're going to start with Palestine here in a minute. Oh, all the invites that did not get answered. And then the Syria thing. We got to talk about Syria. And then, what else we got? Oh, we got a whole police state section today. The murder cops. And then, well, the Iran deal stuff we'll talk about with Gareth, right? We can put off all Iran stuff till then. Oh, and Afghanistan, jeez. Yeah, that's got to go before Yemen, Afghanistan. Yeah, this is how I prepare my show. I sit here and mutter to myself for the first 10 minutes of it. Figure out what the hell is going to happen for the rest. ScottHorton.org is my website. That's where I keep my interview archives and all the rest, too. The whole show archives, too. Sign up for the podcast feeds. If you like podcast feeds, send the links to your friends. ScottHorton.org. Join up the chat room during the show. We're live here noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time, on the Liberty Radio Network. So stop by scotthorton.org/chat, and you can hang out with the guys in the chat room. Hey, guys in the chat room! And then, you know, you guys can talk about El Caminos and stuff, whatever. And then, yeah, man, what else was I going to say? Oh, yeah, you can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. Although, I admit that sometimes I get into gigantic arguments with idiots, and then I can't ever stop arguing until I get the last word. So, you might decide to mute me really quick after you follow me. But anyway. Twitter.com/Scott Horton Show for that. Alright. So, yeah. Palestine. I hate talking about this stuff, man. Did you hear what happened? This morning, Israel time. You know, late last night kind of thing. Israeli settlers set a Palestinian house on fire, burning an 18-month-old baby boy to death. Year and a half old. You know any year and a half olds? You know anybody who was a year and a half and you remember who they were when they were a year and a half old? Think about that. A year and a half old, burning to death. The infant's mother, father, and four siblings suffered third-degree burns on up to 75% of their bodies. This is what's called a price tag attack. Which I'm trying to remember if I ever read the actual etymology of that, where that really comes from. It's supposed to mean, I think it's supposed to imply, you know, it's the price tag retaliation for something Palestinians have done. But yeah, no, more like this is the price of daring to resist Israeli colonialism. We want your land and we'll kill your baby to get it. That's the message. That's what's going on here. It's terrorism. And, you know, I don't know. I could be wrong about this, man. I might have it all wrong. You guys could tweet me or chat room me about it and tell me if you think that I don't understand this correctly, whatever. But I tend to think that probably super majorities of Americans do not understand about the occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza Strip. That these territories have already been conquered. Now, the rest of Israel, when they conquered that, they force-marched everybody out of there. It was horrible. It's called the Nakba. And they came in, and they forced 750,000 people out, killed and raped a bunch on the way. It was a disaster. But it did create what you got to admit is a tenable type situation, mostly in the sense that they created an 80-20 supermajority so that they could be Jewish and democratic. But then in 67, they invaded and occupied the territories where so many of those refugees from before had fled to. And they couldn't get away with just killing everybody or force marching them into the Jordan River or something. They couldn't get away with a second Nakba at that point. So they've just occupied them ever since. Okay, you can stay, but you have no rights. No human rights whatsoever. No property rights whatsoever. And by the way, we're stealing your land. Simple as that. Slowly but surely, piece by piece, they just keep expanding and expanding and expanding the settlements. The plan being that eventually the people of the West Bank will just have had enough and will prefer to go and live in a refugee camp in Jordan instead. And, you know, Mike Huckabee says it, but he's just kind of the argument absurdum, or where he says it in a way where it's so retarded that it exposes the arguments of the rest of the Zionists. Well, let them go live in some other Arab country, right? Doesn't matter if they're individual human beings and have natural property rights or anything like that. They are them, some collective. Let them go live in the desert in Saudi Arabia. Anywhere but here. Why? Because we want their land. Simple as that. And then sometimes at night when they're sleeping, we burn them to death. That's the deal. That's what's what in Palestine right now.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. So, here in the Times of Israel, which is a right-wing paper there, a guy named Avi Issacharoff, who is an Israeli Jew, I think I understand here, has an article. He says, the killing of Ali Saad Dawab, Dawabsha probably, right? Something like that. The killing of Ali Saad Dawabsha will not be the last. Op-ed, Friday's murderous arson attack was not the first of its kind, as I can personally testify. And the perpetrators are confident no one is going to stop them. Imagine for a moment what it was like for Saad and Rehem Dawabsha, the father and mother of Ali, the 18-month-old baby who was murdered overnight when they awoke to find their house on fire. Maybe they were awakened by the smashing of the windows of their home on the outskirts of Douma. Petrol bombs were thrown inside, and the flames quickly spread. The electricity was no longer working, and Saad, according to one of his neighbors, barely managed to find and grab his other son, Ahmad, 4, and get him out of the house. Saad was already suffering from burns and smoke inhalation. The house was quickly engulfed by flame. The neighbors could do nothing to help. At some point, it would have registered to Saad and Rehem, both of them badly burned and suffering smoke inhalation, that Ali was trapped inside and there was no way to save him. The three of them... See, I read something else that said that there were 4 siblings or something, so that was wrong, I guess. Or I don't know. The three of them, father, mother, and 4-year-old boy. That must be where that other report got confused. Or maybe it was just me. The three of them, father, mother, and 4-year-old boy, must have watched outside in petrified agony, slipping in and out of consciousness, knowing that Ali was no longer among the living. And so a family is destroyed. A young family. A baby. Helpless victims. And so their assailants, their alleged Jewish assailants, who, if so, have stained all Jews and Judaism, which, that's nonsense. I don't know how in the world he writes that. I mean, I understand the guy's upset, but that's complete crap. Cold-bloodedly killed an innocent toddler who had barely learned to stand and begin to talk. It's a pretty bad stain on the state of Israel and their right-wing, Lebensraum-seeking nationalist, national socialist, expansionist settler movement. To say that it's a stain on all Jews is absolute libel. If anyone who wasn't a Jew said that, that would be blatant, ridiculous anti-Semitism. That's crazy. And I know it's different when a Jewish guy is saying it, but he's still wrong. But the Israeli state? Hey, the U.S. state that's paying for every little bit of this? Oh, yeah. There's a lot of responsibility there. But I hardly think that's the fault of all Jews or all Americans or any other kind of collective crap. But you know what? Most humans are communists, ultimately, right? Most humans don't believe in individualism at all. So, whatever. They all talk like that. Everybody talks like that. Anyway, unimaginable, he says, the murder of this baby and the horrible assault on the rest of his family. And then he tells the exact same story. Same thing happened. A bunch of Israeli settlers near Hebron, a house, Beit Hamariva, whatever, I don't know, House of Contention. He was a reporter for Haaretz. And they were burning all these homes down. And then so he went, he says it was an attempt at a pogrom. Nice choice of words. I appreciate that. I spotted two soldiers as we headed over and asked them to intervene. They said they were responsible for an entire district and couldn't deal with the incident. We came closer still, and eventually, along with several other photographers, we got into the building under a hail of stones being thrown by the settlers again, that is. Inside, we found hysterical Palestinian women and terrified men, all certain they were about to die. I remember one woman in particular, her face an expression of horror, screaming Allahu Akbar and pleading that we save her. I tried to go back out and shout at the stone throwers to stop, but they kept on throwing stones at us, too. All this time, the flames were spreading. Some of the Jewish spectators were advising the stone throwers where to target the trapped Palestinians. They were not trying to halt the attack. It took 20 minutes for the Israeli security forces to reach the house and extricate all of us, which, of course, as he explains, only happened because he and other Jewish journalists went and basically, you know, put the IDF, the soldiers, in a position where they had to save them and the Palestinians with them. It was a narrow escape from death, to the dismay, I might add, of some people who posted comments on my article at the time indicating regret that it had ended without the loss of life. And anyway, so here's the thing, man. Here's the simple parallel in case it's out of reach for you. The Old South. Right? That's what we're talking about here. And frankly, it's white supremacy is what we're talking about. And I know real white supremacists would hate that because how can you call, you know, Slavs and Jews white, because to them, that's not white enough or whatever. But what do we actually have in Israel? We have a racial system. It's a racial caste system where the Ashkenazi Jews from, who are descended from, you know, Eastern Europeans, basically, with the lighter skin and the lighter eyes, they're on top. And the Middle Eastern Jews are below them as kind of second class citizens. Palestinian Israeli citizens, Muslims and Christians, are lower than that, and then in terms of their actual rights under the law. And then the people in the occupied territories have no rights at all. They have the rights of, you know, an American slave after Dred Scott. None that an Israeli Jew is bound to respect whatsoever. Hey, you have land, I'm going to kill you and take your land. How do you like that? That's the law in Israel. I'm going to kill you and take your land. And then all day, we got to hear about poor little Israel beset by enemies. What, because Hezbollah is strong enough to repel an attack but never launch an offensive one? Syria, which is run by a dictatorship, which might as well be owned by Israel for all the trouble they've ever caused. Although, granted, you know, shortly Israel may succeed in putting Al-Qaeda in charge in Damascus. Then they'll have a threat in Syria. Jordan is wholly owned. Egypt is wholly owned. What threat do they face? They're the threat. This is no different than the KKK bombing four little black girls in a church or the Charleston Massacre. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, man, you know what? I got a new spot to play for you. I hadn't heard back from Ian yet, so I don't guess he's put it in the rotation yet, so I guess I'm just going to have to find the goddamn thing for you myself and just play it for you myself. I got it right here if I just click enough clicks. I just got to keep clicking enough clicks that it gets clicked, and then it'll be clicking for you there.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
Ain't that cool? So I talked to the guy yesterday. His name's Scott Brown. You'd be amazed how little, I guess you just heard, how little you can fit in a 30-second ad. Man, I had all this material, and then, boy, I had to just cut and cut and cut. The guy's name is Scott Brown, and he is a master technician, and what he's all about is modern appliance repair. Some of these fridges nowadays get real fancy, and the old repairmen don't know what to do. So there's a whole segment of the economy there, higher skilled repairmen needed badly, and he'll teach you how to do all of it. And he rules at it, and he's been doing it for 40 years, and he's been teaching it for 20 years, and it's kind of tempting, I gotta admit. I could use a job where I actually make money. Huh. I hadn't really considered that, but the amount of gray hair on my chin and side of my head and... Repairing broken things, huh? I don't know if I actually got the talent for that, really. But it just sounds great, and he seems like a great guy and a fan of the show for a long time, he said, and seems like a great business he's doing there. If you're interested, check him out, MasterSamuraiTech.com. Cool name, too, huh? Yeah, so check that out. Isn't that cool? I should interview him, man. I should have done that today. Then I'd have more guests on the show for you. I'm real sorry about the lack of guests. Gareth is going to be here. And to talk about important stuff, but, oh, cool. Huh? Oh, yeah. He would be. I guess that's good. Yeah. Okay, looks like maybe we'll get Eli Clifton. Wait, let me see. He just got back. It's 12. Oh, yeah. See, we missed it. All right. Well, let's see here. Dang. How about in 10? 4:10. All right. Yeah, that's my buddy Gage. He's helping me out running the show today. Which could be helpful, right? Looks like maybe we'll get Eli Clifton on. That way Gareth can talk about the Iran nuclear deal and Eli Clifton can talk about the politics of the Iran nuclear deal. I really like that guy. He's a great reporter, man. He does really good research and stuff. You read an article by him and you think, man, this thing is really long and in-depth, and he really asked all the right questions and covered all the angles. He liked lifting. He's the guy that did Fear Inc., man, about the professional Islamophobia industry, which, of course, has nothing to do with Sharia law coming to get you and everything to do with just keeping you afraid of Muslims in general so that you'll go along with whatever Israel wants, because it just so happens that all their enemies are Muslims, except the Christians. But anyway, makes it easier for you to identify with them if they can help fill your head with a bunch of nonsense. And, yeah. And isn't it great how it's always liberal American Jews who expose stuff like that? Islamophobia is wrong. And, hey, Israel's policies that they're trying to get you to abet are wrong, too. Eli Clifton doing the good work there. So hopefully we'll have him on here in 10, 4:10 to talk about the politics. It's more than $100 million is being put into the Stop the Iran Deal campaign. Can you believe that? Can you believe people are buying into that crap? Hey, if you can create what seems like a consensus, people will just glom right on. All right, anyway. Back to my new advertiser, MasterSamuraiTech.com. You too could advertise on the show. You want to be an advertiser on the show? Get advertised on the show. I'll charge you a little bit of money, and I'll make you some ads and run them. It'll be awesome. Think about it. Email me, scott@scotthorton.org. And then that way, you've got somebody to keep showing up to do all the debunking of all the things you need debunked. Which is important, you know? There's a lot of things need debunking. Alright, well. I don't want to talk about Palestine anymore. Hey, man. So here's the question, which is a little off topic, but I do have a police state section, so I guess I'll put off Afghanistan and things like that for a minute. And so I'll do this as my segue into the rest of my police state section today. Check on the clock. The question from Shay Machine Riley on Twitter. What would happen if they legalized drugs tomorrow? I'm asking in seriousness. Okay, if they legalized drugs, and I think he puts it that way, not just decriminalized, but legalized as in outright open market transactions and all drugs perfectly legit. Johnson & Johnson can go right back into the heroin business, that kind of thing. Full legalization. Then what would happen is all of the criminals who rely on the drug business for their wealth and power would be out of business right away. And I'm thinking first and foremost of the police. But then also all the evil murderer, drug cartel, warlord types. Once you make a market black, then all the rules of fair competition are out. Now it's simply, you know, the will of every businessman to rule, you know, some kind of monopoly, at least within a given territory, and murder people who dare cross them. That's the way business is done in the black market. Well, and not always outright murder, but severe gangsterism, much worse than an open market transactions. So does that mean every criminal will have to get a job? No, but until you legalize gambling and prostitution, then they'll all have to get jobs. That's what mobsters do. They provide protection for black markets. That's what it's all about. So that would be the first order effect, the first effect of it. And then assuming, you know, if we're talking about a real laissez-faire attitude, that's it. Just the American people tell the government, you're fired on this issue. Just piss off. And we'll figure out something else without you. Then I think that you would have a free market in rehab and it would be necessary. Yes, it's true. In some places, if you could just get heroin on the corner, you would have addiction go up. Some places addiction to heroin is low simply because the supply is low. And it could be worse. I don't deny that. But that's, you know, denying, I don't mean to deny the other factors as well. But the problem of addiction to serious drugs would remain. But the solution to that is people helping people, not imprisoning people. You know, I guess this is just the one anecdote, but I'm sure you've got plenty, and I'm sure the stats are along these same lines, too. I knew a guy with a serious cocaine problem, and he got arrested, and he had to go to all the goddamn stupid evil classes and all the stuff that he had to do on the probation when he got out of jail. I guess he didn't have to, he went in jail for too long. He's in jail, I guess, for a few months or something. And then they made him do all these classes, this and that. He's still a cokehead the whole time. He didn't decide to quit doing coke until he decided to quit doing coke. He realized pluses and minuses. The minuses are outweighing. His life is getting worse, not better, and the cocaine's part of it, and so he just quit, and now he's fine. Now he helps counsel other people to get off of drugs. That's a far more effective way to take care of the problems of abuse anyway. And I didn't even get into even scratching the surface of the problems caused by prohibition, which would almost, you know, universally be abated overnight. It'd be great!
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got Eli Clifton on the line. I admit I didn't really realize this article was more than a week old when I saw Gareth put it out there. But it is a follow-up to our last interview anyway, and I had missed it. So thanks to Gareth, and I don't care. Anti-Iran deal groups backed by, get ready everybody, $145 million. Welcome back to the show, Eli. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here, as always. Great work here.
Thank you.
So, first of all, tell us the good news about who all in power, you're with power, think tanks and whatever, interest groups, I don't know, MoveOn.org, anybody, is actually lining up to push for the deal in Washington, D.C.
Well, I think you've just actually hit on the follow-up article that I published at the beginning of this week, which does discuss the fact that there are a number of groups putting money in and actively lobbying to support the deal. They would include the Plowshares Fund, J Street, Move On, the Friends Committee on National Legislation, Americans for Peace Now, the Arms Control Association, the National Iranian American Council. And, you know, they are all actively fundraising. They are all spending on ad buys. They are all working the Hill and working their contacts to promote the deal and to get Democrats to hold the line and to support the deal. So that's the good news.
Now, as far as, well, just there, and I'm sorry, I missed that article too, Eli, I'm just way behind this week, but the groups that you just mentioned, the Friends Committee, of course, they do great work lobbying. I don't know how much, you know, real money and ability, you know, raw manpower they have for lobbying. You know, maybe you could enlighten us on that a little bit. J Street and Move On, I guess especially MoveOn.org, that sounds like the most promising one, just in the sense of, because it's not really an Israel-oriented group. It is a Democratic Party-oriented group, right? So they're when
that's right.
If they really push, they can mobilize real rank-and-file Democrats to do partisan work on this very important single issue.
Absolutely, and that I think you're hitting on what is the good news here is that, you know, these are very much a number of these groups, even J Street, I would say, are very much out of sort of the Democratic Party machine. They are very much plugged into the party. They have good access on the Hill. Most of these groups have lobbyists who are certainly working overtime. This is probably their number one issue right now over the summer. Mm-hmm. But the bad news is, I think, something you just hit on there, which is that, you know, their budgets are just a lot less than on the other side. The total budgets of these groups are $33 million in 2013. Now, obviously, they don't use all of that money on Iran-related stuff, and right. On the flip side, they're also raising extra money to work on Iran stuff. But just as a point of comparison, that's $33 million for all those groups together. That's the Friends Committee, that's Plowshares, that's J Street, that's Move On, all of them together is 33 million, whereas when you look at the biggest groups that are working to oppose the deal, they enjoyed a combined $145 million in annual budgets in 2013. So if you just look at the dollar figures, they are vastly outgunned.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so, and we talked, the last time we talked, you profiled the millionaires bankrolling this thing, hardcore Likudniks, who make no secret about what their agenda is, and that is trumping American foreign policy with Israeli foreign policy, basically. But now, what's your measure of, and we can get to the votes in the House and that kind of thing in a minute, but just as far as the consensus of people with power, the New York, D.C. corridor, that kind of thing, does it look like this expensive push by them is really making a difference on the margin? I mean, the people who already agree with their agenda already agree, but are they making a big difference with this money, do you think?
Well, I mean, the key thing for them would be to flip Democrats and to somehow get enough Democrats to flip in the House and Senate that they could somehow start to contemplate the possibility of overriding the president on this. And I think the likelihood of that right now still seems rather dismal. It's hard to imagine that occurring. While they may lose a few Democrats here or there on the vote, which is now coming up in, 50 days or something, it seems really unlikely that you're going to get enough to make the difference. Now, we're still early in that process, and right now the focus seems to be on blanketing the airwaves, getting television commercials out there, doing promoted tweets, doing Google ads to try to get people to call their member of Congress, specifically Democrats, and tell them that it's a bad deal and get them to encourage them to vote against it. The polling numbers so far suggest that that Democrats and especially Jewish Americans are actually supportive of the deal, and that overall the deal is relatively popular.
Mm-hmm. Now, these numbers may have changed just with all the hype over the last couple of weeks, but I think right before the deal came out, there was a Washington Post poll that had, I think, 56% of Republicans supported the negotiations. And this is after the framework had been announced. You know, it was the outlines of the deal were known.
Right. And so far, I think it's depending on how you ask the questions, you get sometimes slightly different answers. But for the most part, it seems as if the numbers are holding. I'm just looking here at I think it was late last week. It was on Monday. The Cato Institute and YouGov poll put 58% of Americans supporting the deal and 40% opposing it.
All right. So now it really just comes down to the Senate and the House both, I guess. And just the Democrats on the margin, are they going to stand with their party and their president, or are they going to bow to the will of the Israel lobby? And it sounds like, you know, pretty easy argument that they better go along with the president. But then again, you know, the president's going to be gone in a couple of years, and the Israel lobby's going to be around. And they even announced, I read a thing the other day where they said, hey, you Democrats, we know your names, and if you think we'll ever forget this, you know, you just watch when we bankroll your primary challengers for the rest of your life, you know, or whatever, this kind of thing. That's real pressure. I mean, these guys are not playing around.
Absolutely, and that's definitely the threat that they're going to be making. You know, for what it's worth, I think the tone from the White House has changed. I think it took this president 6.5 years to realize that he was not going to make some sort of common cause with the other side, and that over the course of his entire career, he had largely, you know, based his own successes off of, you know, reaching across and in cooperation and in making deals. It's, you know, in his tone over the past week, it's very clear that he doesn't expect the Republicans to back him on this, but that he's willing to put all the muscle that he can into getting Democrats to hold the line.
Yeah. Well, and it's really, I started to, so now I have to say, it's such a tragedy that Rand Paul rolled over on this when we could be having such fun watching a fight in the Senate among the Republicans about this issue right now.
Rand Paul seems to have largely dropped off the radar on this issue, which is something that I think surprised a lot of his supporters.
Yeah, he poked his head up just enough to say something horrible and dishonest and then go away again, which I can endorse the last part of that at least. but now, and so, is it fair for me to characterize this as simply, you know, just a Netanyahu-Bill Kristol joint going on here? These are hardcore right-wing nationalist Likudnik Israelis and their counterparts here, rather than I mean, I guess, you know, you have the broad Republican movement, but when we're talking about the people who are, they're the target, but the people running this thing, is that basically the only interest lining up to try to stop it?
Well, I would certainly encourage people to just examine who's the biggest donor right now to the Republican Party and to this House and Senate on the Republican side, and that is definitively Sheldon Adelson and his wife Miriam Adelson, and they are clearly very close to Benjamin Netanyahu. They have assisted him in any number of ways, including running a free newspaper in Israel, which is largely seen to be sort of a mouthpiece for Netanyahu and for the Likud party. So I think it's pretty fair to say that at least one of the biggest donors behind all of this and who currently holds the most sway over Republican members of the House and Senate, in as much as dollars gives you sway, which is probably quite a bit, is someone who is very clearly aligned with Netanyahu and with the Likud party.
Yeah. Now, there's the American Conservative magazine, but in D.C., there's really no voice of reason from the right on this at all, is there?
Well, I mean, every once in a while you get interesting stuff out of the Daily Caller. I think some of the more libertarian-leaning think tanks, such as Cato, sometimes does some very good stuff. But I think you're right that right now, in terms of the bandwidth, it's being dominated by groups that are really in opposition to this.
Yeah. Well, and Cato doesn't count. I mean, Doug Bandow, he's a libertarian, and, you know, those guys, even Chris Preble and those guys, are sometimes a little wishy-washy on these issues, but I don't think they could, you know, be called the right necessarily.
And you certainly couldn't say they're the Republican establishment.
Yeah, definitely not. But in other words, though, but there's nobody at Heritage saying, I don't know, I like the deal, guys. I mean, this is just, it's a lock on the right, basically.
It seems like that. Yeah.
All right. Hey, listen, you do such a great job doing journalism and coming on the show. I sure appreciate it, Eli.
Thanks for having me.
All right, y'all. That's Eli Clifton. He's at LoebLog.com. LoebLog.com. Right back. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Hey, I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I guess I admit I'm pretty bad at it. You know, I don't know. At least I'm good on everything, right? So I don't have to be great at broadcasting. I just have to be right about everything. Truth, justice, and the American way, like Superman here, only without the powers.
All right, so I guess I'll talk about this for a minute. So this Nazi murderer, a-hole, Dylan Roof, pleads not guilty. The crawl on MSNBC said he wanted to plead guilty, but his lawyer blocked him and wouldn't let him. And said, no way, Your Honor, we're pleading not guilty on this thing. Not that he personally is denying the action. But anyway, he's entitled to a defense. But here's what's interesting. On my Twitter feed here, the Obama administration, I guess the State Department, has condemned the, quote, vicious terrorist attack after Palestinian toddler was burned to death by suspected Jewish settlers on the West Bank. That's the headline here from the Raw story. And now, so the thing of it is this is bound to bring up the argument, and I guess really the hurt feelings about the use and lack of use of the term terrorism. How come it's terrorism for these settlers in the West Bank, but it's not when Dylan Roof does the exact same thing? He didn't kill a baby, he killed a half a dozen old women instead. That's different. It's the exact same thing. And the thing of it is, I'm not concerned about the hurt feelings thing. I mean, well, I sort of am in a limited way in the sense that, you know, American blacks who see each other shot and killed by the cops on a daily basis around here, who already feel like they have to insist that their lives even matter at all, see how what happened to them, this group of blacks in Charleston, if it happened to anyone else of any other skin color, they'd call it terrorism. Even in the occupied territories, they'll call an attack on Palestinians terrorism. And that's kind of groundbreaking in itself, right? Not that it isn't true, but just that they would say that. But my point is a couple of points. First of all, you don't want them calling things terrorism, because that just means opening up more powers of the state to use against them when the crimes that they're committing are already as illegal as hell. Murder and conspiracy to murder and all of these things. By having the government call it terrorism to make your feelings feel better, like your victims are equal to others, which they are, but I'm just saying, taking this route to feel that way means really you're just empowering the state by giving them the ability to expand their authority in the ways that they can apply it. But secondly, though, I think it's important that regular humans, not the government, that regular humans call terrorism terrorism, not as a pejorative or not because of politically correct, emotional issues, but so that we understand what it is. It's a phenomenon, man, and the better you understand it, then the safer you are from it. Right? So, bottom line, with all terrorism, it's about provoking a reaction. Why do the settlers murder the baby? Because they're trying to, one, get the Palestinians to just run like hell, or two, fight back. I dare you to fight back and give me an excuse to call you a terrorist and shoot you down and finish taking what belongs to you. That's what it's about, trying to provoke a reaction, right? What's Dylann Roof trying to do? Killing innocent people, a state senator, and a bunch of church elders in the basement of a church, right? He didn't go take on black criminals like in his ranting and raving on the internet. When it came to action, he went and picked on the, epitome of the black community. In order what? In order to make people as outraged as possible. In order to provoke a reaction. In order to drive further wedges between people who may or may not already have suspicions of each other. May or may not be wondering exactly what the other is thinking in a way that they didn't before. And I think that largely failed. I hope that, black Americans recognize that the, 200 million white Americans or so or whatever are on their side and not the Nazis' side. But anyway, the point is, if you understand what terrorism is, then you can help make it not work on you, I guess, right? You can inoculate yourself from the knee jerk that they're trying to provoke. So, you're trying to make racists out of it all, huh? Well, watch this, and then act like an anti-racist. Behave in ways to counter racism. Showed you, Nazi. See? Oh, you want us to turn the Middle East upside down and bankrupt the empire, radicalize a generation, destabilize every dictator in the region. Nope, we're just going to cut your throat and come home. Done. See, if you understand that terrorism is about provoking a reaction, then you can puzzle, which reaction are they trying to provoke out of me? And how might I best not fall into that trap? instead of racing, diving headfirst into the briar patch. And so, yes, what happened to this Palestinian family? Terrorism. What happened to the people at the church in Charlotte, South Carolina? Terrorism. And, yeah, and 9/11. And all the Al-Qaeda attacks leading up to it, and since. It's all about provoking a reaction. Look at the way Al-Qaeda in Iraq has always behaved. Attacking marketplaces full of women and children. Shia women and children. In order to provoke their men into attacking Sunni women and children. In order to provoke their men into joining up Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And fighting against the Shia. War is the health of those who are doing the killing. And so, anyway, so you see. Sorry about people's emotions and whatever, but it, to me, it's besides the point. And forget the legal definitions. We don't want to encourage the government to go charging people with a bunch of enhanced this and that, I don't think. I think we want to limit the state in every way that we can. But we do need to understand what it is that people are trying to get us to do, our enemies are trying to get us to do, so that we can avoid doing them. Sorry for, I'm not very articulate or whatever, but I know what I'm talking about. Sorry it takes me saying it six times over before I change the subject again, but that's what I mean. All right, Yemen is an absolute catastrophe right now. I tried to get Matthew Akins back on the show, but he's traveling today and couldn't do it. But he's got, I told you yesterday, Yemen's Hidden War, a journey into the most remote and dangerous, one of the most remote and dangerous countries in the world. I've got, that's at Rolling Stone. Then there's Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Pro-Saudi forces expand gains in Yemen's Aden. Vow to expand from there. Officials say southern port will be new seat of exiled government. Saudi coalition talks up ground operations in Yemen war. Aden takeover, quote, only the beginning. Again, that's Jason Ditz. Millions, millions of humans in Yemen on brink of starvation, according to Oxfam. And worse news than that on the other side of this break. No, as bad. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. So now America's at war with Al-Qaeda in Yemen, right? And has been, right? Obama's been bombing Yemen for 6 years. Used to be Al-Qaeda in Yemen was virtually nothing. Now it's something. I don't know exactly how many men they've got. They've controlled some medium-sized towns at various points. You know, I don't know what percentage of the population they are, but they've been, holding their own. Now, Obama's just drone bombing them the other day. Maybe that's the military drone bombing them while the CIA's backing them. Is that how it works? Or is it the other way around? CIA's drone bombing them. Well, the military is working with Saudi Arabia, flying as their air force, coordinating, picking their targets, running the entire war in Yemen. This is the Wall Street Journal version of the story, okay? And it's, and they weren't exposing it because of what peaceniks they are. They were saying, all right, here's some facts. It's the Saudi Air Force doing the bombing. Of course, it's all American subsidized weapons transfers over there anyway. American planes they're flying. American bombs they're dropping. But it's American intelligence picking the targets, running the war. I think the Saudis can run a war. I mean, not that the Americans can, but I mean, at least the Americans can try to. And yet, all you got to do is just Needle scratched the record for one sec. Who's on whose side again here? Wait, what? Who's doing what now in Yemen? Oh, it's a big damn mess, but at the bottom of the story is what it says. The U.S. is allied with Al-Qaeda in Yemen. The same ones we're bombing. It says right here in the Washington Post. Meanwhile, Al-Qaeda-linked extremists appear to be taking advantage of the chaos to boost their presence. Residents in Aden say the extremists are participating in the assaults by the Saudi-led coalition. Perhaps seeking to win local support. Oh, yeah, all the locals are totally in favor of the Saudis bombing and invading their country. They can't wait to line up with Al-Qaeda to put Hadi back in power. But anyway, I don't know. I guess so. Maybe there are populations of Yemen that would rally around anyone trying to defeat the Houthis. So, the U.S. for decades backed Ali Abdullah Saleh, the dictator of Yemen. Then, when the Arab Spring broke out, virtually all factions in Yemen came together to force him out. So, the Americans pulled off what they had tried in Egypt and failed to pull off in Egypt. And that was push him gently out the door and replace him with his vice president. Replace him with the next mustache in line, as Greg Palast might say. Better than the next beard in line, I guess, in this case. But anyway, so the new guy came in and was pretty quickly driven out of power by the Houthi rebels from the north, who are of the Zaydi sect of Shia Islam, although they have not had big sectarian differences there or anything like that. They all pray together and that kind of deal. But there's sort of a different tribe up there from the north. And the previous dictator had attacked them four different times and had failed to destroy them and their movement. Now, once he was gone, they went back to war and they won. And they ended up walking right into the capital city and taking it over. And in fact, they kept the structure of the old government for a while and just kind of became the new ruling Politburo on top kind of thing. But then eventually the rest of the government, I sort of dissolved and fled. And the Houthis finished taking the place over and drove the new, Hillary's chosen sock puppet Hadi out of power. And they literally had a one-man, one-name-on-the-ballot election for this guy that Hillary praised as the triumph of democracy taking root there. It's the wave of the future. And anyway, then what happened was once Hadi got driven out, the Saudis decided that they're going to blow up Yemen until Hadi takes power back again. And now the deal is the Houthis actually are aligned with now their former enemy, Saleh, the dictator who had attacked them four times. Now he's their leader. He actually was never a Houthi, but he is a Zaydi. Or Zaydi, maybe is how you say it. And so now he has an alliance with his old enemies, the Houthis. And is working to take his power back while his vice president is being backed by the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Al-Qaeda in Yemen to try to put him back in power. Is that Al-Qaeda's agenda, or they're just useful for now? And who's zooming who on that one? Who's more likely to win out on that, Hadi or Al-Qaeda? And they're growing from how big to how much bigger now? And again, for the first time, if you didn't hear it, Mark Perry was on this show, and he's a Pentagon beat reporter for decades in Washington, D.C. This guy's no clown. And he came on the show and talked about he's got generals with stars, I don't know how many, I guess, three or four, saying, what in the hell is going on here? We're flying, they're talking bad about McCain. Saying McCain wants to cry that we're flying as Iran's air force in Iraq? Well, we're flying as Al-Qaeda's air force in Yemen. That's Mark Perry quoting generals at the Pentagon who were saying, look, we like killing people, but do we have to fight outright on the side of our enemies? I mean, creating more enemies by fighting them, that's one thing, but then taking their side all the time? This is getting frustrating. Indeed it is. And you know what? I'm sorry, everybody. I apologize. All roads lead to my hatred of Rand Paul. You see how easy it would be for Rand Paul to beat up every other Republican on this stuff. He could begin every sentence with, "These guys have no idea what they're talking about." And then just completely bulldoze their asses. Give them a pop quiz of whose side they want to take in which of these wars, and then all he's got to do is compare it to the next one, the next one, the next one, and tie them in completely in knots. All he has to do is just get out there and whoop their ass with ease, and instead he's got to pander on all this stuff? What a tragedy. What a waste. Anyway, he does have some talking points that lean this way. Well, we shouldn't overthrow secular dictators. Yeah, but we shouldn't back them either. Why can't you just finish the sentence? We shouldn't back them or back Bin Ladenite rebellions against them. And we shouldn't back communist terrorists against those Bin Ladenites either. And we shouldn't be involved in any of this. That's the rest of the statement, man. Read the Washington Post. It says we're fighting on the same side as our enemies. All right, kids, welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org. For all the stuff, follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Read Gareth Porter at Middle East Eye. Oh, no, I lost him. All right, instead of that, listen to this soundbite while I try to get him back on.
How can you shoot women, children?
Easy. You just don't need them so much. Ain't war hell?
All right, y'all, welcome back. Sorry about that. A little bit of a telephone problem. But, you know, these things happen. It's a live radio show. It has to be this way. On the line is our friend Gareth Porter. He's my favorite reporter. I just love this guy, man. He's also my friend. He writes great stuff at truthout.org and at Middle East Eye. And let me page through my goddamn tabs here, man. I got a lot. Don't know what I'd do without the tab kit. Ex-IAEA official uses misleading claims to attack Iran deal by Gareth Porter at truthout.org. Welcome back to the show. Gareth, how are you?
Thanks, Scott. Glad to be back.
Very happy to have you here. Hey, you know what? You wrote a book called Manufactured Crisis, the real story or the true story behind the Iranian nuclear scare. It's really good. It's the book on the subject. I hope that people will read it. And you know what? I get comments all the time from people saying, man, I'm reading Gareth Porter's book, and it's so great. Seriously, that happened just yesterday or day before.
Thanks.
Yeah, no, it's really great. You do the work. And someone said, oh, there's no audio book of it. You should do the audio book. And I said, well, I can't handle the names, man, the Farsi pronunciations and all that. But here's 6 hours worth of me interviewing Gareth about every chapter in depth of that entire book, if you want to listen to that. So there's that. Anyway, so yes, let's talk about Ollie Heinonen. He's got a reputation around here for always being behind hawkish sort of leaks and interpretations of things. But then again, he's an ex-IAEA official. As you write here, he must really know what he's talking about. So how could you challenge his authority here, Gareth?
Well, as you know better than anybody else, Scott, I've been challenging his authority for quite some time, particularly in Truthout, where I did a piece last year, if I remember correctly, in which I revealed the role that Heinonen played as director of safeguards. He was deputy director of the IAEA from 2005 to 2010. And in the 2008-2009 period, particularly 2008, he was working hand in glove with the Bush administration to carry out an extremely critical maneuver, political maneuver, to create to sort of establish politically the credibility, quote-unquote, of the infamous laptop documents. And the key point here is that before Hynenin made this move in close cooperation with the Bush administration, the IAEA, under Mohammed El-Baradei, then Director General, had essentially refused to treat those documents, which the CIA got from the German intelligence agency. German intelligence agency got them from the MEK. MEK clearly got them from Israel. The El-Baradei regime at the IAEA refused to accept these documents as authentic. They pointed out they were not authenticated. They couldn't be used as evidence against Iran. And so that was the status quo until 2008, when Hynenin became much more aggressive, insisted that these documents had to be treated as credible, and that began to be the language that was used officially in the IAEA reports. This was a sea change, and ever since then, the news media have been compelled, in a political sense, to treat these documents and this evidence, so-called evidence, as credible and really as unquestioned. And so that's been absolutely a strategic shift in the politics of this whole issue, and he's the one who's really responsible. And that's why, you know, I have been following him extremely closely ever since I interviewed him in 2010, late 2010, after he left the IAEA, and found that he really could not be trusted. He's a very loose grip on reality, from my perspective, having talked to him as well as followed everything that he's said and written. He really has a very loose grip on reality, and that allows him to sort of make some very far-reaching, far-fetched flights of fancy with regard to Iran. So that's the background of this piece, essentially.
And that's pretty much the same argument that you're making about his current statements on the Iranian nuclear deal, that he's way out on a limb, deliberately ignoring this, and that truth in order to make his case, which obviously falls apart when you look at the rest of the context.
Right, and he has been he has become the single most relied upon figure in terms of the whole, you know, what has become the central theme of the folks who want to kill the Iran nuclear agreement, which is that this verification system, the system of IAEA access to undeclared sites in Iran, cannot be counted on to prevent Iran from cheating. That the verification system, the system of access, is too loose. It allows Iran to be able to cheat. It gives them a total of 24 days under the dispute resolution mechanism in the agreement. And within that 3 weeks plus 3 days time, Iran can simply clean up any work that it has been doing, even work that might leave some trace of enriched uranium or, you know, some nuclear material. And that's the key point that Hynenin has been harping on in his recent public appearances, articles, testimony. This is the contribution that he's been making to the propaganda movement to kill the Iran deal. So that's what I focused on in my article. And I think, you know, there's a few points to be made, but the one that I think is most important is that when he says that Iran, you know, can remove any traces in a small, what he calls a small project, as opposed to a large project. He doesn't indicate how he distinguishes a small project from a large project, but he simply says if it's a small project, then Iran could remove any traces of what it did in time to allow an IAEA inspection team to come in, because then they would clean up the site, they would you know, repaint the walls, they would, you know, put new flooring in, they would do all kinds of things to hide the traces that might have been there from the work that they did. And by the way, he even suggests that Iran could work on uranium components of a nuclear weapon and still accomplish this. Now, you know, he doesn't elaborate on that, but, you know, if you look at the IAEA 2011 report, which is the Bible for those people who, you know, are following this closely in the news media and who think that they now know what the truth is, that report goes into some detail about this idea of uranium components for a nuclear weapon, and it makes it clear that these uranium components are to be manufactured from highly enriched uranium. So, you know.
So, in other words, what components?
Well, I mean,
just like the highly enriched uranium that I have that I'm manufacturing components for too. As long as we're making up stuff, then yeah, they can do lots of stuff with
the. Well, they are undoubtedly making this up. And,
right. I'm sorry, music's playing. Gareth, we got to take this break. We'll be right back in just a sec and let Gareth finish his thought without interruption, y'all. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberg, a tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. All right, y'all, welcome back to The Thing Here, man. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got Gareth Porter on the line. So the War Party says there's a giant loophole in the Iran deal. That if there's a secret nuclear weapons making going on at the military facilities, that they've got 24 days, almost a month, to clean it all up and sneak out the back door before any inspectors can get in there. And so John Kerry's an idiot. He gave away the store, and obviously the Iranians are going to make a secret nuclear weapon about it. And they're through that loophole, and they're citing this guy, Ali Heinonen, former Mucky Muck assistant director, whatever it was, at the IAEA, who's saying, yeah, they could sneak some stuff out the back door and get away with it, even up to and including manufacturing an actual, the metallurgy on manufacturing a nuclear warhead, and that they could clean up the radiation and the inspectors would be none the wiser. And so Gareth was saying he doesn't buy that. Is that right, Gareth? Oh, I hit the wrong button. I'm sorry. I hit the wrong button like you were on Skype. I get these things mixed up sometimes. Start again, please, sir, and I'll be quiet.
Yeah, what we were talking about at the break is what sort of component of a nuclear weapon he's talking about here. And you said, well, you know, it's undoubtedly a lie, and that's certainly true, that this goes back to a fabrication that is part of the Israeli documentation that the IAEA, thanks to Heinonen largely, picked up and made, quote, credible, unquote, in 2008, 2009, but in 2011. So what we're talking about here is this allegation that the Iranians were working on a component of a nuclear weapon, which is a triggering mechanism, and this is the hemispheric form which has a uranium metal as the basis of it. And that's what he's talking about here. That's what he's claiming. And the point I make in the piece is that that he's completely all wet. He has no ground to stand on whatsoever to make this claim. And in fact, back in 2013, the head of the IAEA's Environmental Sample Laboratory told Reuters that it would be extremely difficult to remove every particle of enriched uranium, despite whatever cleanup might be made in some sort of Iranian site. So he said, quote, you cannot get rid of them by cleaning. You cannot dilute them to the extent that we will be able, that we will not be able to pick them up. And Heinonen actually, when he was asked for a comment on this, admitted to Reuters in this story, he was quoted as saying, quote, complete sanitization is very difficult to achieve if nuclear materials were actually used. So he's now really contradicting his own statement only 2 years earlier.
Right. And now what's funny is this is the one thing that David Albright got right in the world, right, in South Africa, who's sort of the civilian counterpart to Heinonen and leaker of Heinonen's BS over
right.
the years, is that he went in there and found what the South Africans had gone to great lengths to bulldoze and change the entire landscape where they had a secret nuclear facility there, and he went and found it because, you know, his little handheld radiation detector went off, I guess, whatever.
Right.
It's
and since,
virtually impossible, as you say, to hide these
and
most
since
minute
then,
parts.
The sensitivity of the instruments of the technology for detecting enriched uranium has increased enormously. They can now detect 1/1,000,000,000 of a gram of enriched uranium.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty fine.
Right. And never even mind, again, we're just, you know, basically for the sake of their argument here, everybody, we're just closing our eyes and pretending that never mind what uranium got mined and milled and then transferred to uranium hexafluoride gas and then enriched up to weapons grade that now they have it to do this metallurgy on it, right? This is the, we just have to pretend in order to go along with even the bogus theory that they could get the remnants of such work out the back door when in fact they could not.
Yeah,
it's completely
and in fact,
preposterous.
You know, in my story, I showed that Heinonen's fabrication, his fibbing, actually is even worse because in this testimony that he gave before the House Financial Services Committee, don't ask me why he's testifying before them last week, or was it the week before? I guess it was the week before now. Heinonen claimed that the Iranians could frustrate the IAEA. In their inspection efforts, that they had frustrated them, I should say, in 2003, because there were no traces to be detected through environmental sampling in a case that he mentions that took place in 2003. Well, the only case where the Iranians attempted to frustrate IAEA inspection in 2003 is something I write about in my book. And it's well documented. There's no controversy surrounding it. The Iranians, you know, had tried to cover up the fact that they had introduced some UF6 into centrifuges at the Calais Electric Company to test the centrifuges. And so they didn't want to admit that they'd done that in 1999 and again in 2002. So they thought they could get away with this, and they repainted the walls, refloored it, and so forth. The IAEA came in with their ability to detect 1/1,000,000,000 of a gram, and they immediately spotted it, so there was no problem there.
And this is what Heinonen cites as, yeah, that's what they could do.
This is the case that he completely, you know, lies about in his testimony before Congress.
Amazing. And now, so tell me about this other one, too. This is huge, that they could build covertly a small reprocessing plant so that under the nose of the inspectors, even under the expanded regime, so that they could, again, you just have to close your eyes and assume all of his premises here, they could somehow turn off the Iraq reactor, harvest the plutonium, which we all know would be way polluted and light water stuff, not heavy water reactor waste that would be good for a plutonium nuke. Be almost impossible, even with a reprocessing plant, to get weapons-grade plutonium out of this stuff. But they could just, whatever, turn the thing off for a year, let the waste cool down, take the roof off, harvest all the plutonium out of there, then take it to their secret facility without anybody noticing, and then they could make a plutonium core for a nuclear weapon.
Yes, you precisely and very, very nicely summarized this ridiculous case that underlies this claim that he made last year in a paper that he wrote for this right-wing pro-Zionist Henry Jackson Society in the UK, in which he did in fact make the claim that Iran could build a a small reprocessing plant, and it would be difficult to detect, is the way he put it. Well, so I found that very suspicious, of course, as you can imagine, and I found the document, this report that he cites in his report as the basis for his making that claim. Well, it's a very long report done in 2005 by the National Lab in Washington. And I found that not only is there nothing in there that supports the point that he's making, there's no claim whatsoever that it would be easy to get away with this or that it'd be difficult to detect. And in fact, the report actually mentions an effort by North Korea to build a reprocessing plant, which was detected in, I believe, 1987. So basically, again, he was simply lying. I mean, you know, this isn't a guy who is absolutely unreliable. You can't rely on anything that he says or writes.
It's a great way to lie, though, where he says, you know, hey, there's this thing, and then you have to double-check the thing. He's right that the thing exists. It's just never what he says it says, you know,
that kind of thing.
So that's, great propaganda.
And the guy apparently doesn't expect to be checked. I mean, that's part of the deal,
I guess. Then there's Gareth Porter. Exactly. Now, so I got to ask you this, man, because we're almost out of time here. But the samples, this is the new big controversy is, Iran gets to do all the samples. So it doesn't matter, Gareth, whether you can find this or that radiation because you ain't doing the finding. IAEA ain't doing the finding. Iran's just going to hand over what they claim is a sample, and that's going to be good enough for Kerry and Obama, those idiots.
Look, Scott, this is really about this whole new propaganda theme that there's a secret deal between the IAEA and Iran that this is where the Obama administration is hiding the secrets that need to be uncovered. And I just want to observe that there was never any problem with the secrecy of the IAEA up until now, because you know, this was always, you know, the assumption was, and they were correct, that the IAEA was on our side and we could count on them to keep Iran in the dock. And so, you know, the refusal of the IAEA to give out any information about anything that had to do with their contacts with Iran, what Iran had said or done to explain any of these issues in the past, that was just fine with them because their propaganda was intact. Now, you know, there's a problem for their propaganda, and, well, it's not a problem, but a challenge for their propaganda that they're dealing with by simply saying, oh, there's a secret deal. And I think that's all there is to this. We have no idea what the actual understanding is. All we know is that some right-wing fool in the Senate from Idaho is making this claim, and that the administration, you know, is not going to respond because they are they're bound by confidentiality of this agreement between the IAEA and Iran. Of course, the administration knows exactly what's in that agreement, and they briefed members of Congress on it. And this guy is clearly, you know, exploiting what he heard of and turning it in a way that makes it look like it's extremely damaging to the case for the agreement. I simply would regard it as lacking credibility until we find out. That's all I'm going to say about it.
All right. Well, now, yeah, so the AP had a story about it where they say, I'm trying to page down to the part where I think they kind of imply IAEA sources saying, well, they'll be watching on the cameras, and that was the compromise. But then again, that may actually be a paraphrase of David Albright's speculation to them.
Kinds of possibilities, and AP absolutely cannot be relied upon.
Oh yeah, this is the George John story. Yeah,
it's the George John. By the way, when I was in Vienna, I actually met George John.
Oh yeah,
I met George John.
Hey, we're over time anyway, Gareth. So go ahead and tell me the story.
I met George John, the famous George John, and he. I shook hands with him. He said to me, we just sort of passed in the lobby of the Marriott Hotel across from the Palais Coburg. He said, I read your stuff all the time. Enjoy it.
Oh man, you should have went over there and interviewed him.
I didn't interview him. I just shook hands with him.
Oh man, you should have said, "Hey, sit down. I want to ask you some questions." How long have you been working for the Mossad?
Yeah, really. Okay, but I didn't do that.
I'm just playing. All right, it wasn't that funny of a joke, but I try.
No. I probably should have if I'd had unlimited time. And you know, I mean, these people who work for the big media, they were always busy. They were always having their own confabs among themselves. And once in a while, I would have a chance to talk to somebody. But generally speaking, the lines were pretty clearly drawn between the big media and people like myself.
Yeah. Well, that's actually probably for everybody's benefit. So. We won't worry about it too much. All right, listen. Hey, thanks for doing the show and staying over and time and all this stuff. But appreciate you coming back on, Gareth.
My pleasure, Scott. Thanks.
All right, see you. That's the great Gareth Porter, everybody. He is at Middle East Eye and at truthout.org. This one is called IAEA Official Uses Misleading Claims to Attack Iran Deal. And he's got a new one coming out next week. I guess I won't say where, it'll be a surprise, but he's got a new one, a big, deep story on the entire nuclear deal. All right, see you.